good morning, everybody. We're ready to start. Believe it or not, we're going to get going here. Okay, so this is Bio 241. Sign-in sheet is going around. Your name is not on that sign-in sheet because I didn't have time to print it out, but please sign in. It does say 241 and the date, and then you'll get credit for being in class. And your exams are graded. They're in Blackboard. A number of students have looked at their exams, so I recommend that you come by office hours and take a look at your exam and read the questions and see if you misread something or rushed too fast through questions or what you did to answer the questions correctly. Right, so I think you can get some information back on that. And so you're welcome to look at those. You got 2 weeks to look at an exam, and then after that, it'll be difficult for me to find them. And for sure, after that time, even if there's a mistake on the Scantron, I won't give you credit for it. All right, so we just need to keep pace in the class because it moves really, really fast. All right, so before I turn the lights off, let's take a look at the schedule. So indeed, the 24th, right, we did have an exam on these chapters. That's over with right now. The exams are not cumulative, but you really can't forget much about these previous chapters. Right, because that will hurt you in this class, even though tests are not cumulative. All right, so today I have an asterisk right there. That means that there was a disaster drill earlier this morning. That we're past that, we don't have to worry about that. And in the lab, except for maybe the people that go until 7, they might have another one. All right, the chapter that we're going to look at today is chapter 4. All right, you guys, you're going to have to stop talking, although it's fun. I hate to inhibit you guys from talking to each other because that's super important, but you might be disturbing somebody that's next to you. So, if you're talking about that's even better, but you're still bad. Okay, so we just got to pay attention. Chapter 4, enzymes and energy. All right, does anybody have a question on the test or stuff in Blackboard or schedule, for instance, anything like that? We're ready to start talking about enzymes and energy. All right, I tell you what, let's look at when is the next test. It is going to be on a Tuesday, just like the first one, and that's going to be March 24th. That's going to happen before spring break, and there's 4 chapters on that test, right? 4, 5, 7, and 9. All right, so now I get to turn the lights down. I don't want to buzz the microphone. That, is that good? Better? How's that?
Looks good.
That's good. Okay. I can't see you guys. Maybe you can see me. Let's postpone this update. We'll put that away. Okay. And then we're going to go to here. All right. So enzymes and energy. So first we're going to talk about enzymes. We've got to define what an enzyme is. And then we'll talk about what it does and some nifty features about enzymes. And then we're going to get into a little bit about a metabolic pathway, and then something that everybody will enjoy is bioenergetics, some laws of thermodynamics. We're going to talk about some laws of thermodynamics. That's going to be helpful for you to understand some of that stuff as we proceed through the course. Arrow options visible. Okay, here we go. So what the heck is an enzyme? An enzyme is a biological molecule. How many kinds of biological molecules did we particularly study in this class? There are 4 of them, right? What were those 4? Carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, okay? And enzymes almost exclusively are proteins, right? And you know something about proteins, they have a primary structure which produces a secondary structure which produces a tertiary structure, right? So the shape of these proteins is all important. It determines what their function is. And if we change the shape of a protein, then the function of that protein is going to change as well. And since there are 20 different kinds of amino acids can be put in a whole bunch of different ways, there can be a lot of variability in proteins. There's just almost an unnumber of different kinds of proteins that can be made. So enzymes are proteins. Right? And they have to be built and put together to have the exact right conformation in order for them to work. And what they do is that they increase the rate of a chemical reaction. That is their whole job. So there are some chemical reactions that might take place in your body, but it might take 1,000 years for that reaction to happen. And of course, we don't have 1,000 years to wait around for that reaction to take place. And so an enzyme will speed it up so that it will happen in less than a second, right? Very, very rapidly. And the way they do that is by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. And I think what we need to do is maybe define what a reaction is. We've all had some chemistry now. What the heck is a reaction? All right, I'm going to say a reaction is A plus B going to C plus D. All right, and so these things here are reactants, and they're going to go to products. All right, so that's a nice chemical reaction. And on this particular diagram, you see that it's a one-way arrow. So that's how we're going to consider it. Not all reactions are like that. Some reactions are bidirectional. Can happen backwards and forwards. Okay, so if there is a reaction like this in your body without an enzyme, like I said, it might take thousands of years to produce products. But you need those products before those 2,000 years come to pass. Right, so an enzyme will speed up that reaction. It won't change anything about the reaction, right? It's always going to produce C and D. It won't produce like Z and Y. It won't change the reaction. It will just speed it up. And if the reaction can't happen, an enzyme cannot make it happen. It only speeds up the rate of a reaction if it can occur. All right, so here is a really important slide. A lot of test concepts come off of this slide. Probably is an exam figure as well. And you see a bunch of graphs. And when you look at a graph, the first thing you should look at and understand are the axes of a graph so that we know what we're looking at. All right? But even before we start looking at the axes, I want you to see that it is arranged in columns. The first column is dealing with a non-catalyzed reaction. And the second column is what happens when we introduce an enzyme and the reaction is catalyzed. All right, so we're going to be comparing non-catalyzed with catalyzed with these various graphs that we're looking at. Okay? Does anybody have a question about that so far? So far, so good? Okay, let's look at the top row, the first row. The first row, and now let's start to look at some of these axes. We have number of reactant molecules, right, which would be what? Like A plus B over here. As we increase the number of reactant molecules, what happens to the rate of this reaction? How fast does C and D be generated? Okay, as we increase the reactants, then the product increases as well. And if we look at all of the energy of the reactants, the energy of these reactants right here, they don't have exactly the same energy. Some are moving around faster, some are moving around a little bit more slowly, and that is just due to temperature. If we measure the energy of these reactants, we see it's not a single energy, but there's a distribution of energy levels in A plus B over here. Right? There's not just a single energy level. And in order for this reaction to take place, there has to be a certain amount of energy in these molecules to make the reaction happen. And this little area over here that's colored in this little orange area, this just signifies the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction. Okay, so this is with what kind of system? Catalyzed or uncatalyzed? Non-catalyzed reaction. All right, let's go over to the other column. We see something about the distribution of number of reactant molecules versus the energy that they have. And can you see that, is there a difference? Here's my question. Is there a difference in the distribution of these molecules? What about the shape? Shape is the same. And where does it start? Same, starts at the same place. Where does it end? Same place. What about the height? Is the same. Okay, so I got to ask that question one more time. What about the distribution of this energy of the reactant molecules from a non-catalyzed to a catalyzed reaction? What is changing? There's really nothing changing. That's really what I wanted you to tell or to see. The energy distribution of these reactants are exactly the same in terms of shape, okay? But you do see something different, and that is the proportion of all of the molecules underneath this curve does change, right? So this area right here represents the number of molecules that can undergo the reaction that is not catalyzed, as opposed to the second column. What can you tell me about the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction? There's more, a lot more. Even though we didn't change the distribution, we didn't change the temperature, we didn't do anything special to those reactant molecules, it just so happens that many more of them now can undergo the reaction. Okay, so that's what this distribution shows. So let's look at the second row down here to understand something about how enzymes work. So now here we have a plot of energy versus, this is like the rate of the reaction, right? And we're going to start with reactants and we're going to end with products. Which of these species have more energy? Is it the reactants or the products? Yeah, reactants, right? Because we're just looking, I see a nice arrow right here, right? So as you go up higher on this axis, then you have increased energy. And as products are formed, guess what happens? Some energy is released, is lost, right? And so the products have less energy. And I tell you what, you probably know something about this reaction. What kind of reaction is that in terms of energetics? Is that endothermic or exothermic? Did you get that in lab just yet? It's exothermic, right. So exothermic is when the products have less energy compared to the reactants. All right, and remember, this column right here is without an enzyme. So let's take this block wall away. If we roll this reactant over to the edge of this hill and then just give it a little nudge, right, will it roll down the hill all by itself? Yeah, it will, right? Very easily, it will roll down. But in real life, there is this energy barrier, this block wall. So in order to get this ball to roll down the hill, what has to happen? You have to put energy into the reactants to get over the wall before it can start to run down. And then as it runs down, do you get that energy back? Do you get that energy back? You put this amount of energy in to get the ball over the wall, and after it's over the wall, it goes from here to here, you get that energy back. Right, so that exactly cancels out. And then the energy that's released is from the top of this hill down to the bottom. Right, so that's the energy released. This amount of energy that's necessary to get reactants up with sufficient amount of energy to get over the wall, we call that the activation energy. Right, and so, for instance, all these nice tabletops that we have here, they're made out of wood, for instance, at least parts of them. All right, and what could you tell me about that wood? Does it want to spontaneously change into something else? No. And the answer is, yes, they do. They want to change in, all these dust want to turn into carbon dioxide and water, but all of these molecules don't have sufficient energy to undergo that reaction. What would we have to do to change all that wood into carbon dioxide and water? Yeah, all we have to do is light a match, put a match underneath that wood, inject some energy into that wood, and it's going to burn. And as it burns, it turns into carbon dioxide and water. Okay? All right, so that is an uncatalyzed reaction, and lighting that match would be like putting in the energy, right, to get the reaction started. Right? So if you maybe even want to draw like a little match in right here, for instance, that would be activation energy. Okay, so this wood is stable because there's a big activation energy that's preventing it from turning into carbon dioxide and water. All right, well, let's introduce an enzyme. Go away. Where's infinity? 4 hours? That's close. Okay, let's get back to our slide. So here is the same graph as we see on the left. Now, this is with a catalyzed reaction. So it's just a plot of energy versus the reaction as it proceeds, right, after we put an enzyme in there. So what is the energy level of the reactants from the left-hand column to the right-hand column? Exactly the same, right? It's at the same level. What about the energy level of the products? exactly the same level, right? So the energy of the reactants doesn't change compared to catalyzed, non-catalyzed. Energy of the products doesn't change from catalyzed to non-catalyzed. Well, what is different, right? We see in this top row that there are many more molecules when the enzyme is present that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction. So let's take a look over here, right? And we said that was the activation energy. And let's look at that block wall barrier. Is the block wall barrier the same between non-catalyzed and catalyzed? No, it's not. It's a lot smaller, right? And so that's what an enzyme does. It reduces the necessary activation energy, right? So this reaction can proceed much more rapidly. All right, so between, we're going to look at the bottom row, compare left and right. Which one has a greater activation energy, one on the left or one on the right? One on the left, which is the non-catalyzed reaction, right? Compared to the catalyzed, the activation energy is reduced. Now, what about the energy that's released when we compare left and right on that bottom row? Is the energy released greater when it's a catalyzed reaction or less? It's the same. Fantastic, right? So this really nice green arrow, okay, should be the same length as this nice green arrow over here. An enzyme reaction, enzyme catalyzed reaction, doesn't release more energy. It just makes the reaction happen faster if it will happen on its own. That's the only thing that an enzyme can do. And how does it do that? By decreasing the activation energy. I want to give you a little bit of an example, okay, of what is happening there, maybe in the next couple slides. Okay, so a mechanism of action of these enzymes, right? So it's the ability of an enzyme to lower the energy requirement due to structure of these molecules, right? Remember, enzymes, most of them are proteins. 99.999% of them are proteins. They have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape. We call that a conformation. And on the surface of these proteins, there are sites or pockets, you might want to think of them as pockets, called active sites. And the substrates, which we see over here as A and B, right, have to bind to those active sites. So what can you tell me about the shape of A and B compared to the active sites? Yeah, same shape, or complementary shape anyway, right? So there has to be a nice relationship so that these substrates fit in the active sites. All right, and then the enzymes are formed so that when substrates bind to the active sites, it brings the substrates together in just the right way so that a reaction can take place. And so the active sites have to be close enough to each other so that both of these substrates or reactants will come in contact with each other. So here is a pretty good illustration that describes that. And it also describes some other things. So what do we got right here? A plus B, reactants, and we got an enzyme in there that's going to go to C plus D. Oh, I didn't know this little reaction was in this slide. That's nice because that's what I drew on the board. The only thing that I would change here, perhaps, if it is an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, I might want to change this word reactant to substrate. Yep, to substrate, right? So substrates bind to enzymes to produce products. And even if this is a reversible reaction, then sometimes you would want to consider a product as a substrate for the reaction. But for right now, just change reactant into a substrate. Yeah, for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. It's got to be an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. And this enzyme is what? A protein inside a cell someplace, for instance. All right, so in this reaction, all right, how many substrates do we have?
Two.
You got two. We've got A and B. How many enzymes do we have? We just got this one enzyme. And can you see an active site? Yeah, so here substrate A can bind to the active site on the surface of this enzyme, and substrate B can bind to this other active site. Substrate A can't bind to the active site for B because it doesn't have the right shape. Right. So what do we call that when the shapes of these molecules have to match each other before binding can take place? Whether it's a transporter molecule or anything like that. We call that specificity. Specificity, right? When a substrate has to have the right shape. All right, so the substrates bind to the enzyme, and when they do, look what happens. They touch each other. Okay? And not just in any random way, just in a very specific way, and it's always going to be this way. No other way will they touch each other. And when that happens, the chemical reaction can take place. Right? And then the substrates are released from this enzyme substrate complex, and now we have products floating around in solution. All right, so we get products only if something forms first. And what has to form before products can be produced and released? It's the middle step right here, and that's called the enzyme substrate complex. Products cannot be produced if there's no enzyme substrate complex formation. And what's necessary to produce this enzyme substrate complex? The shapes of these molecules, right? Okay, and you can change the shape of this protein by increasing the temperature, right? By boiling it, for instance. We call that denaturation. Okay, so that is something special. The other thing that I see really nice and clear is what happens to the enzyme during this reaction. Let's look at the enzyme. What about the color of the enzyme before the reaction compared to after? The same. Are you kidding me? No, it's the same. All right, good. I meant it to be the same. What about the shape? It's the same. What about the number of these little globules all over the place? The same. So what's the difference between the enzyme before and after the reaction? Absolutely nothing, right? So the enzyme does not get used up during a chemical reaction. The only thing that changes is that the substrates decrease in number and the products increase in number as a result of this enzyme-catalyzed reaction. Yeah, question.
Since the enzyme doesn't change, does that mean it can undergo
this
process?
Yeah, it sure can. That's one of the important features of a catalyst, whether it is a biological catalyst like an enzyme or any other kind of catalyst, an inorganic catalyst that we use for other kinds of purposes, all right, in our daily lives. Catalysts are not used up when they undergo the reaction. And that was really important a number of years ago when we used a certain kind of fluorocarbon for air conditioners. And it was very nice to make good cooling systems with this particular gas, but it would leak out of air conditioner systems, get in the air, go up into the ozone, right? And it would break down the ozone layer that was above us, and the importance of the ozone layer way high up in the stratosphere is that it blocks ultraviolet light, which is very damaging to biological systems. So that chemical that we use for air conditioners were basically making our planet inhabitable because it was now getting irradiated with ultraviolet light. Because that fluorocarbon was a catalyst, right? It would produce that reaction, but then again, over and over and over and over and over and over again. So that was breaking down that protective layer. And it's very difficult to get rid of a catalyst once it's out in the environment. All right, so any kind of catalyst. All right, so the enzyme is not changed. All right, so substrate fit into the active sites? Yeah. Enzyme substrate complex has to form in order for the reaction to proceed. All right, the reaction occurs, the products dissociate, and you're left with that enzyme to catalyze the reaction over again, right? And since it can catalyze the reaction over again, that speeds up the overall number of products that are produced in a certain period of time, thus speeding up the rate of that reaction. All right, so how does an enzyme speed up the rate of a reaction? Okay, it's not directly specifically described on this slide in words, but I see it. It does so by reducing what? The activation energy barrier. Okay, so that's an important thing. So maybe I'll turn the light on for just a second. Over here. That one, and that one. Okay. So right here, I have a couple markers, right? I have a black one and a red one. Okay. We're going to consider these to be substrates, and there's going to be an enzyme where these substrates can bind to because they have the proper shape. Okay? And so they bind to the enzyme just like this. Now they're in the proper shape so they can join together end to end. So what do you see? Red, black, black, red, or what? Red, black, joined together end to end, right? So that's the job of the enzyme. It puts them together just like that. But if these substrates were floating around in a solution someplace, how many different ways could they bump into each other? Millions of different ways, right? They could bump into each other like this, or like that, or like this, or like that, right? Or like that. Millions of different kinds of ways. But if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, how do the molecules bump into each other? Just like this, so that the proper product is produced, and it will be produced very rapidly. It's just because of the surface structures and the shape of the substrates together. And when that happens, that decreases the activation energy barrier, because these molecules are always bumping into each other in the right way for the reaction to proceed. All right, so that's how I think of a catalyzed reaction. Here is something that your book doesn't make a big deal of, and that is, when these substrates, when they bump into each other, okay, without an enzyme, they bump into each other all kinds of different ways, they can react. Okay, they can react. So instead of producing a substance like this, they can produce a substance like that, right, which is maybe not what you want in your body. And maybe it's even toxic, right? Maybe for sure it's something you do not want because it's toxic to your body. So what an enzyme does is that it produces something very rapidly, but what? Exactly what the molecule that you need is, not a side reaction. An enzyme inhibits the production of side reactions, or it stops side reactions from taking place. So the efficiency of this reaction is 100%. You guys could never do an experiment in chemistry lab at 100%. Okay. So that's the other beauty of enzymes. And how that's the reason why they're being used in industry, because they're very efficient to make a particular product and fast. All right, so that's this slide. Before you have a question, is there any color that relates this slide to this previous one over here?
Yes.
Like enzyme? Yeah, I don't know. They seem to be like the same color somehow, but I don't know. Take a look at it, and if you see how color is related of that enzyme substrate complex to that energy diagram, let me know. Okay, I just don't see it. Okay, there was a question though. Yeah.
So can you show the when the end? Yeah. Okay. So by looking at the big picture, how can we know where the activation energy goes?
You put activation energy in, and you get it out, and so it comes and goes without you even knowing that it comes and goes. And on this particular diagram, it's just because of the shape of the substrate molecules and how they are joined together when an enzyme is present. They can only touch each other just in this particular orientation, which will mean that the proper products will take place. All right, if you have these two substrates without the enzyme, they can bump into each other millions of different ways and the reaction won't take place, or worse, another different kind of reaction that your body does not want. Okay? So that's that activation energy. When these molecules bump into each other just in the right way, that reduces the amount of energy that's necessary for that reaction to take place. Okay? And I guess one way to think of that, if we increase the activation energy of these substrates, right, they bump into each other much faster. So they bump into each other randomly, but since they bump into each other faster, then sooner or later they're going to bump into each other just the right way for the reaction to take place. Say if we were to increase the temperature.
As long as they have
the activation energy and the enzyme, then you go in the right direction. Yeah. Okay. And with this enzyme, you don't even need the same activation energy level. It's decreased. Okay. And somebody had a question about a catalyst. We talked about wood, about how it likes to just turn into carbon dioxide and water. There's a way to make that happen at low temperature while keeping the energy of that wood exactly the same. And what would we need to do with that wood? We'd have to put it in contact with a catalyst, right? And that catalyst is a metal and it's zinc. So if we were to put a bar of zinc on wood, it would eventually just burn a hole right through wood at low temperature without flame. And how would it do that? By reducing the activation energy for that particular reaction. Okay? Okay. I don't know how anybody would know that, unless you have a boat, for instance. Okay. So how do we name these enzymes? We're really interested in knowing them. The modern nomenclature is that we take the substrate that they work on and put an ASE on the end. That's a suffix. Or maybe some other kind of word that you see an ASE, then you know that it is an enzyme, something that's going to speed up the rate of some kind of chemical reaction. And there are classes of enzymes. Sometimes they are labeled according to their activity. You know, sometimes it's sort of like muscles, right? Some muscles cause flexion, so those are going to be called flexors, flexor digitorum, for instance. Okay. A phosphatase is an, and you know it's an enzyme, right? Because there's an ASE on the end of that word, and you know it's going to have something to do with phosphorus. And by definition, a phosphatase removes a phosphate group from a molecule. And it could be a large protein, could be a small protein, okay? Could be mostly proteins, I suppose, could be sugar molecules. Phosphatase, remove. A kinase does the opposite, right? It will add a phosphate group to some place, and it's just a specific place, and it's got to be in a specific way because it has the right shape. All right, so what's the relationship between a phosphatase and a kinase? Most important concept in anatomy. Yeah, most important concept in physiology, right? Antagonistic control. So it might seem silly to have an enzyme running around phosphorylating things and another enzyme running around taking that phosphorus off, but you know you would never drive a car without a brake pedal and a gas pedal. When you have an antagonistic system like that, you have precise control and balance of what is happening inside the cell. All right, so at the enzyme level, we see how important antagonism is, right? Can you give me a quick example in the musculoskeletal system why antagonism is important? Okay, it's Thursday night, Friday's coming. Friday night is coming. Yes. For instance, if you're pulled over by, did I mention this before? I forget about you guys sometimes. Ever get pulled over by the people in a fancy blue uniform, badge and sidearm, and they say, put your fingertip on your nose? And how are you able to do that? Because you have a biceps that flexes and you have a triceps that extends, so you have precise control of balance where this index finger goes, right? Unless you're intoxicated, right? Then the system doesn't work so well and you end up poking the officer in the eye, okay? Okay, so antagonism is very important. That's just a musculoskeletal example, right? Here is a biochemical example of how important antagonism. What about nervous system? How could you convince me that antagonism is important in your nervous system? I heard sympathetic, parasympathetic, and I heard autonomic nervous system. Yeah, that's really nice. Okay. The name of an enzyme may specify the enzyme or the substrate of the enzyme, like a lipase. It's an enzyme because you have an ASE, and what's the substrate for a lipase? A lipid, but we don't call it that. It's a lipid, yeah, lipid, okay. All right, so as an example, dehydrogenase works on what molecule? Lactate, and it takes a hydrogen off. Okay, and we're going to look and see some other kinds of things. Here are some enzymes. All of these are pretty important in your body. We're going to talk about some of these in the class. Catalase. Right, is an enzyme that can convert two of these hydrogen peroxide molecules and convert it into water and oxygen. Really good example to review what an enzyme does. Right, do you have any hydrogen peroxide around? Maybe not on you, maybe at home, maybe in the washroom in a sink someplace. What kind of bottle is hydrogen peroxide always in? Dark colored bottle, never a clear one, right? Because what hydrogen peroxide likes to do this, it likes to convert into water and oxygen. It will just break down automatically just like that. And we like to keep other kinds of energy from entering that bottle, like sunlight, that will speed up that reaction because you paid a lot of money for hydrogen peroxide, not for water and oxygen. So this reaction will take place spontaneously. Okay? But there is an enzyme that will speed up the rate of that reaction. And if you cut yourself, okay, and you pour hydrogen peroxide, which is what the substrate for catalase, what will happen to that cut? It will start to bubble up, right? You'll see a bunch of bubbles on it. Those bubbles are from oxygen, and water will also be produced. That oxygen is toxic to many bacteria. This water irrigates the wound. It kind of washes the wound out, and so that's a nice way to treat a fresh wound. And what happened to that hydrogen peroxide? Did you have to wait there like all afternoon? No, it's like very fast, right? So that is a nice enzyme-catalyzed reaction. Carbonic anhydrase. I do want you to know this one. This one is going to interconvert carbonic acid into water and carbon dioxide. So this is, we know it's an enzyme because of the ASE right here. And carbon dioxide is not an organic compound, but is it important in our bodies? Yeah, our bodies produce carbon dioxide all the time. And one of the important mechanisms that our body deals with carbon dioxide, right, is by converting it into carbonic acid and then bicarbonate. So when we get into the respiratory chapter, that's going to be really important to look at. I won't talk about these other ones right here, but a ribonuclease will hydrolyze nucleotides, ribonucleotides, right, because nucleic acids have information in them, and if these information molecules invade your cells, then that can change the activity of your cells. And so we have all of these different kinds of enzymes that will break down DNA and RNA that doesn't belong in our body. So that's handy, right? So what do we call it when a big polymer, right, and water join together to make something smaller? What kind of reaction is that? Yeah, it's just a hydrolysis reaction, right? Okay. All right, so this enzyme activity, we just said, is the rate that substrates are converted into products. And many enzymes, especially in our body, are sensitive to temperature, and they're sensitive maybe to salt concentration, certainly sensitive to pH. All right, so as you change the pH, look at what happens to enzyme activity. For pepsin, at a very acid pH, it has an optimal activity. And as we increase the pH, changing it from acid to neutral and then even to a basic, what happens to the activity of this enzyme? Yeah, it decreases, right? The rate of that reaction decreases. So what is happening to pepsin when we change the pH of it? Or the pH of the solution that it is in? We're changing its shape, as a matter of fact, right? We're changing the shape, or its shape is changing. I guess we can say we're changing it, but it is changing, right? And as the shape of the enzyme changes to where the active sites don't have the proper shape, then substrates can't bind to it. Because that hydrogen ion can cause ionization, and it can put electrical charges in different places along that protein, and that will change the conformation of the protein. So pepsin has an optimal pH around 2, between 1 and 2. That's a perfect enzyme to do an initial digestion of peptide bonds in the stomach. And so that's why this is in the stomach. Salivary amylase, neutral. This is in your mouth. Okay? Yeah, pretty close to pH 7. And trypsin is a protease that is in your small intestine, which is the opposite of your stomach. That is an alkaline pH. Now, pepsin and trypsin were named before that modern nomenclature was developed, and that's why we don't see what on the ends of these words. There's no ASE on these, right? So we don't want to change their name because everybody knows what they are. Okay, also temperature plays a role, because as we increase the temperature of a protein, the way that it bounces around in solution, the way that it wiggles or stretches out and goes back, right, will change the conformation, change the shape of a protein when we change the temperature of it. So here we have a protein, an enzyme, and it's catalyzing the reaction. If we increase the temperature, what happens to the rate of the chemical reaction? It increases. It's directly related, right? And that's because as the temperature increases, substrates will bind, it will bump into the enzyme more rapidly, and then when they have the right approximation, then the reaction can form. So the reaction rate will increase, but what happens when we get to a really high temperature? Okay, above physiologic temperature of 37 degrees. What happens if we go to 40, 50 degrees? Then, yeah, these proteins are moving around very rapidly. They're stretching, twisting, bending, and they're twisting and bending so much that they can lose their natural configuration or conformation, And when they change shape, what happens to the active site? It is no longer there, right? It changes. The shape of the active site changes to where you should think, oh, well, that active site really isn't there anymore. So as the temperature increases and the active site is no longer there because the protein has changed shape so much, yeah, I have something really nifty to tell you guys, but I forgot what it was. Okay. Okay. That process, okay, is called denaturation. Right? So the protein has lost its shape, right? And so as it's losing, as the active site, came back to me, as the active site disappears because we're increasing the temperature, the rate of the reaction, right, decreases. Then as we increase temperature, it is now inversely related to enzyme activity. Right, so increase temperature, decrease. All right, so what is not forming as we increase the temperature and get into this inverse relationship between temperature and enzyme activity? What is no longer forming?
Enzyme substrate complex.
Yeah, don't forget about this enzyme substrate complex. This has to form before substrates are produced. So this explains what is happening there. When the temperature changes so much, this enzyme here is twisting and being pulled apart, right, from side to side, top to bottom, and it changes the active site so much that the substrates can't bind to it. These active sites are changed as the temperature gets above the physiologic level, that the shape of this protein no longer has active sites on it, so the substrates can't bind to it. And if the enzyme substrate complex cannot form, then these molecules don't bump into each other just the right way to produce these products. Right? And a really good key thing to understand right there that everybody just kind of uses and explains a lot is that the enzyme substrate complex can't form. That means a lot. That means what? Active site is going away somehow. It's changing. Okay. And to a lesser degree, the shape of the substrates are changing with temperature, right? But if they're proteins, of course, then the shape of the substrates even change. But usually people just think about, right, the shape of the active site so that the enzyme substrate complex cannot form. Okay, so we saw that there is this ascending limb of activity where temperature and enzyme activity are directly related. Then we have this descending limb over here. And let's just stay on this ascending limb. Let's start at zero and increase the temperature to 30. What's going to happen to the rate of activity of this enzyme? Yeah, it goes up. What happens if we take it back down to 20? It slows down, but is it still happening?
Yeah.
Now what if we go from 20 to 30? What happens? It speeds back up, right? And what happens if we go back down to 20? It just slows down. So in this region right here, right, this change in activity is reversible, right? It is reversible. You can change the activity of this enzyme just by picking a particular temperature. Now, if you get over the plateau and get into this descending limb of enzyme activity where activity is inversely related, right? Let's say we take that enzyme and we bring it up to 100 degrees and activity decreases because the active site has changed. Now, let's take it back down to 37 degrees. Right, on this graph, it makes it look like the enzyme activity is going to come back. And when we go from 100 to 37, this graph makes it look like the activity is going to come back. But will it?
No.
No, you know it won't, because denaturation is an irreversible process. It's catastrophic. And you all know that happened to me last night. I cooked some hamburgers just perfectly on the grill. I was about ready to sit down. And I was even going to share one of those hamburgers, but I got a call on the telephone, and some of my friends at the pool hall said, we got three people, we need a fourth person, and of course, I would just put my hamburger in the refrigerator, come back and get it later, right, and go shoot some pool first. Now, when that hamburger was nicely cooked and put it in the refrigerator, the temperature of it decreased, but did that cooked hamburger ever go back to looking like an uncooked hamburger? No. And what would you invoke to explain that? Denaturation is irreversible, right? There's only, I know of two examples now, one kind of for sure, one maybe not so sure, and that is when somebody gets a permanent in their hair. Some people can relate to this, but maybe not a lot of people. Guys can't, probably. When you get a permanent, you take your hair on your head to a beauty salon someplace, And they use some very strong chemicals and break a bunch of disulfide bonds between different parts of a protein. Protein makes up your hair. And then they put your hair in the conformation you want, like if you want it curly, they put it in curlers. And then they reform those disulfide bridges, right, stabilizing those proteins. So now you have curly hair, and it will last for a pretty long period of time. But maybe the next day you say, oh, you know, I thought that was a good idea at the time. It sounded really good, but I don't really like that. I want to go back to straight hair. You can go back to that same beauty salon or a different salon, and they can put those same chemicals on your hair, straighten your hair out, right, and then put some more chemicals to reestablish those disulfide bonds, and now you have hair that is straight once again in a permanent situation. That's why they call it a permanent. So that's an example of a protein being denatured, okay, and then renatured. But those are pretty severe cases, and that's the only one that I know of. But there's some scientists at UCI that said that they have done that with an albumin protein. I heard of that last week, and I don't know if that's ever been replicated in another lab anywhere, and I have no idea how they were able to get a liquid egg white into like a solid white egg white, and then back to liquid once again. Seems pretty amazing. Second, yes? Yep, pH changes the shape. Salt concentration changes the shape because there are positive and negative charges on proteins. Same charges will repulse each other, so those parts of that protein will repulse each other. If they're opposite charges, they'll attract. Those parts of the protein will be joined together. And as you change the pH, you change the arrangement of all those positive and negative charges on the protein. And so sometimes, without we had a proper pH, the enzyme will be joined together, and with a different pH, that same area of the protein might be repulsed from each other because the electrical charges change. That changes with pH. That changes with salt concentration. And, okay, we just saw about how you can denature a protein with heat. Another way of thinking of denaturation is cooking. We cook a lot of our foods, but we can also cook foods at low temperature by adding salt or acids. Right, that's a way to preserve food as well. Okay, and if you preserve a food with acid, you can't ever get it to go back the way it was either. Okay. Yeah, question.
But how about if too heat, they denature.
Yeah.
How about too cold? Like under
will cold denature a protein? Usually we don't think of it, but it can, but mostly because of mechanical reasons. As we start to freeze water, as it gets cold, if we freeze water, so we got to get it really cold. When we start to freeze water, right, water solidifies and it becomes a big particle. When enough particles form around a protein, it can actually push on the protein. And maybe it can even fracture the protein, right? So if we freeze something, then there's a chance that those proteins can be denatured, just because of the mechanical disruption, because of the ice lattice that's forming around it. Maybe. Okay. That's kind of a weird example. Okay. Cofactor. Oh, yes. Question. I know. Dang it. I hate it when that happens.
Even though there are a few rare exceptions as denaturation goes are not being irreversible, yeah, for our test, you just want to say that always irreversible.
It's irreversible. Yep. Irreversible. Yep. It's irreversible process. Okay, here's two definitions that I want you to know. We're going to use these definitions a lot in this class, and there aren't many classes that use this exact definition, and so when somebody talks about a cofactor or coenzyme, you have to be really careful about what they are referring to in another kind of class, or if you end up in a clinical situation or a laboratory someplace. All right, but let's define for this class what a cofactor and a coenzyme. All right, a coenzyme, right, can speed up the rate of a reaction. And what can you tell me about regular enzymes? Are they organic or inorganic compounds? Are they biological or not biological?
Biological.
They're biological. They're big molecules. Coenzymes are big organic molecules. They're huge, right? And they have a particular shape. A cofactor, on the other hand, is just a metal ion, right? It is not organic. It is not huge. It is tiny. It has a particular shape and a particular charge on it. I don't know what happened. Something strange happened. Okay, who did that? Okay, came back. Okay, so a cofactor is small. A coenzyme is large, big. That's the best way to think of it. All right, so cofactors include metal ions like calcium, magnesium, manganese, copper, zinc, selenium. We need all of these in our body, not in large quantities, but in very minute quantities. And these are cofactors that can help an enzyme speed up the rate of some kind of reaction in our body. A coenzyme, right, are derived from vitamins. They're large organic compounds. And what a coenzyme does in this class is it's going to transport some little molecule from one enzyme pathway to another enzyme pathway. So it's going to transfer something from one place in the cell to another. You could think of it maybe even as location. So it's going to transfer. So coenzyme is a big organic molecule transferring some molecule from one place to another. Right? A cofactor, on the other hand, is just a simple small ion that has some kind of particular shape and particular electrical charge on it. So here we have an enzyme. We got a couple substrates. And it's going to catalyze the reaction, and we're going to get this enzyme back. And if we look at these substrates, it might be a little bit hard to tell, but it has active sites, but the active site is not really, doesn't really match up with the substrates. Okay, so the substrates won't bind to the active site of this enzyme. But if there is a cofactor, like one of those metal ions, and it binds to the enzyme, that's going to change the conformation of the enzyme so that the substrate can fit into that area. Look at this. See this big lip right over here? That's what we didn't see here. Right, this big lip. This big lip only forms when the cofactor binds to this particular site. And this site is it the same or different than the active site? It's different. Right? When a cofactor binds to an enzyme regulating its activity at a site other than the active site, we call that allosteric regulation. I don't know if you've run into that in lab yet or not. Allosteric? Wow, I really need to modify this slide. Allosteric. Okay, that's one example of what a cofactor can do. Here's another example. Here the substrate really won't fit in to the active site, right? But if a cofactor binds to its binding site, all right, now the substrates can bind. So what can you get when you have an enzyme-substrate complex? Yeah, you get products. That's kind of a trick question, but kind of thinking about it backwards. And so that's missing from this diagram right here. All right, and when a cofactor binds, now is this in the active site or outside the active site? This is right inside the active site. We call this orthostatic. Orthosteric versus allosteric. So there's two different ways a cofactor can bind to an enzyme. Sometimes when it binds, it speeds up the reaction. Sometimes when it binds, it inhibits the reaction. It all depends on the enzyme and the cofactor and how it works. Okay, so I see some horizontal arrows that show the enzyme and substrate becoming enzyme-substrate complex. From right to left on the top row and the bottom row. Then I see another arrow right over here. This is not a direction sign. This is not saying that this enzyme substrate complex turns into this one. Okay, it's just kind of pointing out saying, hey, here is where that cofactor ended up. And this arrow here is saying, hey, this is where the cofactor ended up. It's not showing a pathway of these two complexes. All right, so cofactor coenzyme. Enzyme activation. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form, and I'm sure we're all really happy about that. For instance, pancreatic enzymes for digestion in the small intestine are produced in the pancreas, and if they were activated in the pancreas, then they would digest the pancreas down. And unfortunately, that happens, so it's really sad and serious when that happens. But in a normal person, those inactive enzymes in the pancreas are delivered to the small intestine, and in the small intestine, they become activated where they do their job. Okay. Who knows a condition where pancreatic digestive enzymes are activated within a person's pancreas? Called pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, a number of different kinds of situations, right? And you can imagine what it'd be like to have your body being digested from the inside out. That's not good. Okay, so this particular action of producing inactivated enzymes, protects the pancreas from self-digestion. Many of these enzymes, that we're talking about from the pancreas or other places are activated by phosphorylation, and they're inactivated by dephosphorylation. What kind of enzyme is used for phosphorylation? Phosphorylation is adding a phosphate to something. That is a kinase. You're gonna have to just memorize that. Too soon, you just heard of it a couple minutes ago. Dephosphorylation is produced by a phosphatase. Right? So turn on, turn off. It's like a light switch. Up, down, antagonistic motion, antagonistic control means you have precise control and balance. Others, activated by ligands, small molecules called second messengers. Okay, where do you always find the second messenger? Inside the cell, cytoplasm. Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell, for instance. Yeah, so this is some kind of transduction scheme where something outside the cell can alter the enzyme activity of stuff happening inside the cell. That's nice. Okay, well, we kind of mentioned this already. Here we see a graph of rate of reaction versus substrate concentration. And in the initial stages of what's happening here, as we increase substrate concentration, what's the relationship between the rate of the reaction and substrate concentration? Yeah, it's going up. How do we say that? Kind of nice. I like that. Yeah, it increases. I like that. But what's the relationship? Yeah, it's really nice if you just think about it like that. It is what? Directly related, right? If you hear something directly related, what picture should you see in your mind? This graph right here, right? You should just see something increasing as you go from left to right. Directly related. All right, but does that happen forever if we increase the substrate concentration? Does that relationship always stay directly related to each other?
No.
Over here, we see that we can increase substrate concentration and there is no further increase or decrease in the rate of the reaction. Okay? And that's because all the active sites, when we get to this region right here, are occupied by substrate. Even if we put more substrate in there, there aren't more active sites to form the enzyme substrate complex, and so the rate of the reaction just levels off. So this plateau region right here we call saturation. And we saw that in membrane transporters, right? And so we just use what the understanding of shape of the transporter or an enzyme and the shape of the substrate or the molecule that's being transported, right? It's all by shape. Somebody have a question? Did I see a question someplace? No. Okay. All right, reversible reactions. I drew an irreversible reaction on the board, but here is a hugely important reversible reactions. So let's pay particular attention to this one. Right, some enzymatic reactions are reversible. They can go forwards and backwards, right? And they're even catalyzed by the same enzyme. And so you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, how does your body figure out if it wants to make products or if it wants to make reactants? Because it can go backwards and forwards. Right? And it just uses a really simple chemistry law. It's called the law of mass action. More commonly, I think it's called Le Chatelier's principle. Is Le Chatelier ringing a bell for anybody? Probably take a chemistry class. I should have that on this slide too because it's hard to spell Le Chatelier, but it's Greek for somebody's name, right? Sort of. It's French. Sorry. It's French. All right. So what does that say? Okay. It just says that this reaction is going to proceed from high concentration of these compounds to low concentration. So what does that mean? If we put a lot of CO2 into this bottle where this reaction is taking place, it's going to force the reaction to the right. This is carbonic acid. Right? If we decrease the carbon dioxide concentration, what's going to happen? It's going to force the reaction to the left. That's the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. And of course, the opposite happens over here. If we increase carbonic acid concentration, it's going to force the reaction to the left. If we decrease the carbonic acid concentration, it's going to force the reaction to the right. And since this is a double-ended arrow, we know that the free energy of water and carbon dioxide is almost exactly equal to the free energy in carbonic acid. And so that's what determines whether this is a freely reversible reaction. There's no energy change. It just goes from one to the other. Metabolic pathway. I'm going to flip through some of these slides. Okay. I might go through this kind of fast. Metabolic pathway is just a sequence a number of enzymatic steps that happen in your body, and the conversions between these different substrates is controlled by an enzyme. So I see that we have an initial substrate A can be converted into B if enzyme 1 is active, right? And then B can be converted into C and D and E if enzyme 2, 3, and 4 are activated. And then finally, E is converted into F. That's the final product that your body needs. And that's even a different enzyme. That's enzyme number 5. Right? All of these substrates between A and F are what we call intermediates. Right? So they're not really products. They're just intermediates. And each one of these, right, have to form an enzyme-substrate complex until the final product is made. Okay. And so you might be wondering, well, how come the whole world just isn't filled up with F, the final product? Well, because there's regulation that takes place with these enzymes, maybe by phosphorylation or dephosphorylation that we just talked about. And where does that take place? So here I see an enzymatic reaction, A being converted into F. F is the final product. Okay. Or, for instance, A can be converted into F prime with some other enzymes. And there might be competition between these two different pathways. And how does your body know what to do? Well, this bottom pathway is producing F prime. F prime builds up inside the cell. F prime can bind to enzyme number 3, and when it binds to enzyme number 3, it's going to change the active site, thereby decreasing the activity of this enzyme. So if it decreases the activity of enzyme 3, what happens to the buildup of F prime? It decreases. Okay. So as F prime increases, it's going to force the slowing down of the reaction that produces it. That's what? A nice negative feedback mechanism. Where this really happens is at a branch point in metabolism. Right? When C has two fates, it can become D or D prime, depending on what enzyme is active. Right? But if F prime inactivates enzyme 3 prime over here, then the only pathway is for A to go through the top route to become F. And so regulation usually happens at this point right here, which is what we call the A branch point. Can you see like a branch right here? That thing can have two possible fates. Right? And this usually occurs by allosteric inhibition. All right, so that means F prime binds on this enzyme 3 prime, but where does it bind if it's allosteric inhibition? Not at the active site, but some other site on the enzyme that is distant from the active site, but sufficiently close enough to change the shape of the active site and inhibit. So if the enzyme 3 prime is inhibited, what can you tell me about the enzyme substrate complex formation? It is decreasing. Yeah, it's decreasing, right? So that this product won't be made. Okay, so intermediates in a long biochemical pathway. Bioenergetics. Got to get to this one because I'm set up to give you a demonstration. All right, so bioenergetic refers to the flow of energy in living systems. Actually, yeah, because we say bio. If we talk about energetics, we're just talking about the flow of energy anywhere. But I'm not sure any of this makes sense unless you know what energy is. So we got to talk about what the heck is energy. Anybody have a nice working idea of what energy is? Yeah, it's the ability to do work, right? So it's not something we can measure with a scale or pH meter, thermometer, anything like that. But it's the ability to do work. And the first law of thermodynamics states that energy can be transformed from one form to another, but can't be created or destroyed. So what about the amount of energy in our universe from millions of years ago compared to now? This is going to be the same. All right, so it can't be converted from one form to another, but can't be created or destroyed. And in millions of years from now, the total energy in our universe will be the same. It's just going to be distributed a little bit differently. So what the heck could that mean? What kind of energy do you use in your car? What kind of energy, right? You need energy because your car is going to do work. It's going to carry you around to various places. So it needs energy to do that work. And so what kind of energy does your car use? You use gasoline. Most people use gasoline. Now, what form is that energy? It's a chemical, yes, energy stored in chemical bonds. Okay, and that energy stored in chemical bonds is converted into mechanical energy that moves pistons up and down, that turns a crankshaft, that turns wheels so that you can go places. So That obeys the first law of thermodynamics, where chemical energy is converted into mechanical energy. That's a pretty good example. Okay? That's almost my favorite example, but not quite my favorite. My favorite example is photosynthesis. What is photosynthesis? What does that entail? Okay, taking oxygen. Okay. We're going to talk about it just a little bit. What can actually make photosynthesis happen? Okay. But what's the factory? That's what I'm asking. What's the factory of where photosynthesis takes place? Yeah, plants. Green plants, for instance. All right. So what does a plant do? It makes glucose molecules. How many carbons are in glucose? Six. There's six in glucose, and those carbon molecules, those carbon atoms come from carbon dioxide. So a plant can take six carbon dioxide, join them all together to make a sugar molecule out of it, right? But it requires energy. Where does a plant get energy from? From light, right? So a plant can take light energy and convert it into what kind of energy? Chemical energy, yeah. And then we can use that chemical energy to do things in our body, or the plant can use that chemical energy to do things in its body, right? And so that is another example of the first law of thermodynamics, right? So energy, we can think of a lot of different ones. Like if we flip that switch over there, we're going to change the electrical energy into light energy, right? So we can flip back and forth. And it's not efficient. It's not 100% efficient when that happens. All right, well, let's look at the second law. I want to get through this, at least, before we end class. Second law states that energy transformations increase entropy, right? And entropy is the degree of randomization, the degree of disorder in a system. All right, so right now I see you guys sitting in chairs in certain rows. I see a lot of organization, which means that this group has low entropy. Now, if we were to put you all in a bottle, shake you up, and you go all over the place, then you would, right, have more entropy. It's just the degree of disorganization. And it says here that only free energy, energy that's in an organized state, can be used to do work. And it also means then that systems tend to go from states of high energy, right? High energy is what? Organized or disorganized? High energy is organized, right? Systems tend to go from states of high energy or organized to states of lower free energy, which is what? Disorganized, right? So systems like to go from organized to disorganized levels. And I'm going to turn the lights on. I'm going to have to turn the mic down just a little bit. Okay. And what do I have on the table right here? I got some dominoes. Do you see any organization in these dominoes right here? You don't? I see some on top of others. I see some flipped up. I see some flipped down. I see a little bit of organization here. It's not completely randomized. If it was completely random, right, they would just be like all over in one layer on the table. And here I see like two or three different layers. Okay, so I see a little organization here. But let's compare it to another set of dominoes. Okay, what about this set right here? Does it show more organization or less than that? More. Which one has more entropy? The disorganized one has more entropy. And how does chemistry or all physical processes like to work? Going from high entropy to low entropy, or low entropy to high entropy? Okay, so it's going to go from highly organized to lower organized. And can you see that happen? Okay, I'll do the experiment. Okay, but I might have to have help. Who will help me clean it up if I do it? You guys will. Okay. So, what spontaneously will take place? Will these disorganized dominoes ever become this organized mass of dominoes? Okay. Will that ever happen? No. Not without the input of energy. But what about these organized dominoes? Will that spontaneously turn into this pile? Yes. Right? So, things will go from low entropy to high entropy. But what do we need here to make that happen? We need a little activation energy, right? We need a little active, not very much. Okay, I'll stand right here. And, oh, almost all the way. All right, I'll just poke it again a little bit. Okay, so will these dominoes right here ever go back to that really nice building that I made? No, unless something puts energy into that system. Like I built it, right? But I had to put energy into it. All right, so things will go from organized to disorganized state, right? And that maximizes entropy. And that's just what this slide here says. Systems tend to go from states of high free energy to states of lower free energy. Highly organized states have high free energy. Disorganized systems have low free energy. All right, here we have my favorite chemical reaction. And I'm really jealous of this green thing right here. Okay? Because we see that this green thing can take carbon dioxide that's in the air and some water vapor that's in the air, maybe it sucks it up from the ground, and it can make glucose out of it. As long as it has, and glucose has, what, less entropy compared to these. Right? So here's a highly ordered state, here's a disordered state, and you can see the free energy. And we said that things only have a tendency to go from high free energy to low, but plants make it go the other way. How can they make it go the other way? By getting energy from some other place, right? Like that building got built because it got energy from my body to do that, right? Because I used my muscles to build it. Same thing for this plant. It can take this highly randomized set of chemicals and produce something with a lot of structure to it, but it needs energy from the sun. And here's a little byproduct. It produces oxygen as well. Okay, so this energy, this light energy from the sun, where does it end up? In the chemical bonds of this glucose, right? So I think that's exactly what we talked about. So a plant with photosynthesis can take light energy and convert it into chemical energy with this process. And that's why I'm just really jealous of plants, because they can sit on the beach all day long and like drink a milkshake all day long. All they need is light in order for that to happen. Okay, so do you understand this free energy increasing as we order these molecules? That's the second law. The reverse of that is true. If we take a highly organized molecule like glucose and convert it back into CO2 and water, right, then the entropy is increasing, right, energy is being released. So glucose and oxygen, we can see, is really high in free energy. CO2 and water, very low in free energy. That's a nice spontaneous reaction. And as a matter of fact, wood is made out of glucose and put together in a certain way. And we can burn that wood. We can combust it and turn it into carbon dioxide and water, as long as we overcome that activation energy with a match, for instance. Right. And when chemicals go from high free energy to low free energy, releasing energy in the process, we call that what? Endorganic or exergonic? That is an exorganic reaction. That's right. Exorganic releases energy, and reactions have a tendency for that to happen automatically. Okay. In our bodies, it would be really nice if we can harness this energy to do other kinds of things, like muscle contraction. And we've got a nice chapter coming up, cellular respiration, that shows us how that happens. Okay, so here is an exorganic reaction, glucose going to CO2 and water. Now, when we produce ATP, okay, ATP, do I have a slide right here? Well, here it is, kind of complicated form. Here is ATP. And how many phosphate groups does ATP have? Adenosine triphosphate has 3, and there is energy in these chemical bonds, and as a matter of fact, there's high energy in these chemical bonds. And in order to make ATP, you need ADP, which only has 2 of these phosphates, and then an inorganic phosphate, this thing here just floating around in solution. All right, so in order to make ATP, we need ADP and inorganic phosphate. We end up with ATP, but this is an endorganic reaction. Endorganic. All right, so what you have to put in this reaction is ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus energy, and you get ATP. That's an endorganic reaction. Let's go the other way. If we have ATP, right, and we go the reverse way, and we make ADP and inorganic phosphate, what else do we still have up over here? We still have energy. Right, so when you break down ATP to ADP, that releases energy, and what kind of reaction is that? Exorganic, right? That's an exorganic reaction. All right, but to make ATP, you have to have that energy available in order to make ATP. So that's what this diagram here shows. Here we have a couple wheels that are connected together. They have just the right shape. And we have a big wheel and a small wheel. And on the side we see a representation of free energy. And the big wheel, we have reactants with high energy and products with low energy. So what kind of reaction is that, going from high to low energy? That's exorganic, right? It's going to release energy when that happens, and we could calculate it by reading off the numbers on this vertical scale over here. All right, that energy can be used, because of this fancy mechanism, to turn this smaller wheel. Right? And which direction is this smaller wheel going to turn? The opposite direction. So it can take reactants that are in low energy, right, and put that energy in to make products that are higher in energy than the reactants. And that's what we call an endergonic reaction. Okay? Okay. So which one is more like breaking down ATP? The big wheel or the little wheel? Breaking down ATP. Okay, this big one right here. Right, this is the big one. It releases a lot of energy. Okay? Now what about when you make ATP? It's a small one, right? The reactants are ADP, inorganic phosphate, plus energy goes to ATP. So in order to make ATP, it has to be coupled with another class of reactions. And what's the energetic of those other reactions? Are they exergonic or endergonic reactions? What does this say right here? Exergonic. In order to make ATP, which is an endergonic reaction, there has to be another set of chemical reactions that are exergonic that can release that energy to the process of making ATP. And that exergonic reaction is usually some kind of hydrolysis reaction, breaking a big molecule down into smaller ones. Okay. All right, so that's why this, sometimes your book is a little funny. It says something about how exergonic reactions are necessary to make ATP, and it's pretty confusing because you know that when you burn up ATP, that is an exergonic reaction. Most exergonic reactions in your body are used to make ATP. Most exergonic reactions are these reactions over here. These reactions over here make ATP so that when ATP is hydrolyzed, it can give that energy to some other kind of process. All right, so ATP is produced by exergonic reactions. Ah, there's a question someplace. Yeah. Exergonic, going from low entropy to high entropy. Okay, and there is a way to include free energy and entropy together to know if a reaction is spontaneous or not. We don't cover that in this class. Maybe in chemistry you do. It's called enthalpy. And we're not going to get into enthalpy, but it's a combination of entropy and free energy changes. Okay? And then you know if a reaction will happen spontaneously or not. Not purely entropy, but that's not a bad way to start thinking about it for this particular class. All right, so this chapter, so you recognize this. This is what, a nice ribonucleotide with a couple extra phosphates on there, right? That's not a deoxyribonucleotide. Here's adenine. All right, when we come back after the weekend, we're going to talk about oxidation reduction reactions. These are easy, but really tricky. Okay, and we don't mean to make them tricky. I think it's just so easy that it's tricky. Okay, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please.